Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from North Rim Bank, supporting educational programming across Alaska that inspires children of all ages to learn and grow. NorthRimBank.com.
If you put a hard construction date on there, I'm not sure that that allows us to even go forward.
On the final day of the legislative special session, debate on the LNG gas line bill continues. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, June 19th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Anchorage Mayor Suzanne LaFrance proposes tax breaks to incentivize new home buying.
If your tax bill is lower for 10 years, then you can put more of your income toward payments on that house, right? So it makes it easier to actually get into that house in the first place.
Alaska Public Media is all about community. Wear your community on your sleeve with the purchase of branded clothes and collectibles from our online store. Visit alaskapublic.org/shop.
It's the last day of Alaska lawmakers' special session on a bill reducing taxes for the Alaska LNG project. As of 4:45 this afternoon, lawmakers were still debating changes to the bill ahead of a final vote. Governor Dunleavy and pipeline developer Glenn Farn say a measure replacing a 2% annual property tax with a much smaller tax on gas throughput is essential to allowing the project to attract investors and court lenders. They applauded the version of the bill that passed the House a week ago. A draft approved by the Senate Finance Committee this morning retains many of the House's provisions, but there are some important changes. Maybe the most important is the timeline. To be eligible for tax relief, construction of an in-state pipeline would need to be complete by the end of 2032. Senator Bert Stedman, a Sitka Republican and Finance Committee co-chair, says that's a response to a looming gas shortage.
There's been a lot of concern out of the rail belt with the declining volume in Cook Inlet, furnishing gas to mainly the Anchorage Bowl area.
But the more aggressive timeline sparked concerns from minority Republicans on the committee, worried that it increases the risk on an already risky marginal project. Senator Mike Kronk, a Tok Republican and Senate minority leader, said the aggressive timeline could be, quote, a poison pill.
That's very damaging. I say, how do you know, there's so many factors that we don't control or happens out there. So if you put a hard construction date on there, I'm not sure that allows us to even go forward.
Governor Mike Dunleavy and the pipeline developer Glenn Farn have yet to comment on the bill as a whole. As debate began on the floor this afternoon, the Senate debated amendments tying the tax breaks to a separate tax change. The measure would subject pass-through entities in the oil and gas business, including LLCs and S corporations, to the state's corporate income tax. Senator Forrest Dunbar, an Anchorage Democrat, says it's an attempt to make up for an expected loss in oil tax revenue as North Slope producers invest in gas production.
It's a bill with a PFD and school-shaped hole in it that we are trying to repair. We need to repair this bill so that the people of Alaska don't see a substantial loss in their income during the construction phase because of the lease expenditure issue.
Republican Senator Rob Myers of Fairbanks spoke against the tax change, which would subject large oil and gas producer Hillcorp to state income taxes. He said senators hadn't studied closely enough what the change would mean for oil companies' plans.
We've modeled the state revenue. That's definitely true. We haven't modeled what this amendment would do to future investment and future production, not only with Cook Inlet, but also up on the North Slope.
Lawmakers approved the change 11-9. It would take effect in 2028. Debate on further amendments was ongoing at deadline. Glenn Farn, in its only comment so far in the Senate's version of the bill, says the tax change could damage its chances of getting financing. Lawmakers also attempted today to override 5 of the 9 vetoes Governor Mike Dunleavy issued Thursday. They were successful on 2, a bill extending a state board of engineers, architects, and land surveyors, and another bill allowing pharmacists to treat minor and chronic conditions. They failed to override vetoes of three bills, one increasing oversight of youth and psychiatric hospitals, another creating a state-managed retirement program for small businesses, and a third requiring the state education department to develop guidelines for mental health instruction. For the latest news from the state capitol, go to alaskapublic.org. You can also watch through KTOO's live Gavel Alaska coverage. Anchorage Mayor Suzanne LaFrance's administration is proposing two ordinances aimed at fostering new housing construction in the state's largest city. The proposals would add tax exemptions for first-time homebuyers purchasing what the LaFrance administration calls starter homes, and for people buying newly built condos in underused commercial buildings. Nolan Clauda, a policy director for LaFrance, says most new homes built in Anchorage are more expensive than the city's average assessed household value of around $490,000.
There are people out there who are buying those, right? But if you're talking about people who want to buy a home for the first time or people who have more median level income, they can't buy that house.
The first ordinance would give a 10-year property tax break to the first-time homebuyer purchasing a newly built home that is at or below that average value. The other ordinance would give a similar break to people, first-time buyers or otherwise, who buy and live in condos that are newly developed in mixed-use buildings. Clauda says the benefit would help incentivize the building of newer, cheaper housing.
If your tax bill is lower for 10 years, then you can put more of your income toward payments on that house, right? So it makes it easier to actually get into that house in the first place.
For home builders, says Anchorage Home Builders Association President Skylar Quinn, the concept of a tax break for first-time home buyers is great on paper, but Quinn says he's concerned with the price cap on what homes would qualify. He says recent increases to labor and materials expenses have often made the cost of building an average value home in Anchorage more than the homes are worth.
If the cap is $490,000, that's just it's a really tough number to hit. I would like to see it. I don't know at what number, but certainly something higher than that.
The two ordinances are in addition to a number of tax incentives the city has taken up in recent years in order to reach LaFrance's goal of 10,000 homes in 10 years. Other proposals the Assembly has approved include a tax break for the construction of multifamily buildings with more than 8 units and a break for remodeling abandoned and vacant properties. LaFrance's newly proposed ordinances are set to be introduced at the Assembly's next meeting on June 23rd and could be approved as soon as July 7th. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the state works on new proposals to strengthen rural health care.
It has been really inspiring and humbling to see how engaged people are.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska Public Media is all about community. Wear your community on your sleeve with the purchase of branded clothes and collectibles from our online store. Visit alaskapublic.org/shop.
The state of Alaska has advanced more than 400 projects to the next step in its grant application process for the Rural Health Transformation Program. That's a federal program to strengthen the state's rural health infrastructure as the country faces huge cuts and eligibility changes to federal health care programs. Alaska is expecting to get and distribute more than $1 billion over the next 5 years. The state requested that organizations, hospitals, and clinics send letters of interest outlining potential projects as they compete for the funding. State Health Commissioner Heidi Hedberg says the project has three primary goals, first and foremost being the betterment of Alaskans' health.
We know that to drive towards better health outcomes, we need to strengthen our workforce in healthcare and lean into technology and innovation. Third, we hear from our providers, which are our doctors, our nurses, our healthcare workers, that they need stability in different payment models, and we're calling that pay for value.
Hedberg said the state has received more than 1,800 letters of interest for the grant funding. Of those, she says more than 400 have advanced to the application process. Some projects were deferred to a later stage of the program because they're better suited to start once the state's health infrastructure is stronger. The state denied some that were not aligned with the project's values or allowable by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the federal office overseeing the project. A few projects also received planning grants so the state can help the organizations make a clear plan. The Rural Health Transformation Program's timeline is tight, and both the state and applying organizations have been working to meet deadlines. Allison Miller, a program coordinator the state brought on for the project, says watching the process is uplifting.
It has been really inspiring and humbling to see how engaged people are and how motivated they are to help other Alaskans and improve health outcomes. And I think that is something that all of us have really appreciated as we have done this. It really serves as kind of a guiding star as we go through this process.
Full applications are due to the state by June 22nd. Applications will be reviewed by subject matter experts and evaluated according to the Department of Health's publicly posted evaluation matrix. Hedberg, the health commissioner, says the state anticipates implementation grants to be awarded August 1st. Ketchikan's Fawn Mountain and Point Higgins Elementary Schools recently held their final day of class after the district decided to close the schools amid budget issues and enrollment declines. And while students in the district are relocating to other schools, so are all of the supplies they use. KRBD's Hunter Morrison has more on what's next for those buildings and the supplies that were once in them.
In the parking lot of Houtling Elementary School, 80 Roth wheels a flatbed dolly to a U-Haul truck that's crammed with tables and chairs. A large desk, used during Roth's time as principal of Fawn Mountain, is loaded onto the cart. It's just one piece of about 20 years of Fawn Mountain supplies that have been brought to Houtling and other schools over the past month. Roth has also helped move art supplies, shelving, musical instruments, and other items that were used by students and teachers at her school.
It's what we have to do, so that's why we're doing it.
Roth says Fawn Mountain staff began decluttering a few months ago, following the school board's vote in April to close both schools in an effort to save money. The district is over $5 million in debt to the borough, which owns the buildings. The assembly will ultimately decide their future, and right now, that future is unclear. Fawn Mountain and Point Higgins could potentially host students who attend Ketchikan Charter School and Tongass School of Arts and Sciences, whose shared building is in need of improvements and repairs. It may be required for students to eventually relocate. Borough Assembly members say even though the schools are moving, they want the buildings themselves to continue to be used by families island-wide. Some have stressed the importance of preserving the buildings at a low cost and keeping the ball fields and outdoor recreation facilities open. Assembly member Jamie Palmer said in May that she'd like to involve the community in determining the building's future.
But I'd love to see some community engagement to that regard of which buildings and why and what else could be utilized. And is it nonprofits? Is it what? What is it?
All that's known right now is that next school year, students from both closing schools will be directed to Houtling Elementary and its gymnasium, and classrooms are quickly filling up with supplies from the now closed schools. Both schools' library materials have also been sorted through. Point Higgins librarian Laura Powers says some of her library's books have been distributed to other schools in the district. Others have been donated to schools around the state, from Craig to Yakutat to Stebbins in western Alaska. Because of budget cuts, most library services in Ketchikan's school district have been cut. Powers, who's curated Point Higgins Library for the last decade, says she hopes that selection is put to good use.
You know, I've selected the best literature for these students, and I know what they wanted to read. I know what they're interested in. So I've worked very hard for this for the students in the community to have the best literature.
Back in the parking lot of Houtling Elementary, young adult employees of the Clover Bay Lodge are individually grabbing stacks of chairs and moving them into the gymnasium. Some were once students of the district and are helping out their former teachers. Others, like Briar Kind, are just in Alaska for the summer.
Yeah, it's good to, you know, help the schools out, especially when they won't give them, you know, funding and stuff. And just kind of sucks that, you know, they're shutting so many schools down, but glad to help.
Members of the U.S. Coast Guard, the South Tongass Volunteer Fire Department, family and friends of school district employees, and others have also helped with the move. Roth, who will be principal of Schoenbar Middle School in the fall, says the relocation has required a lot of manpower.
When you throw in all of like your daily summer traffic into there, it adds on so much, and so you just, it's just a lot of time and effort. And all of our bodies hurt.
Teachers and volunteers will continue moving supplies from both now closed schools over the coming weeks. The borough will continue maintaining the building with basic utilities and upgrades. A work session is scheduled for August 24th to discuss the usage of the buildings. With reporting help from Sydney Dauphiné, I'm Hunter Morrison in Ketchikan.
The University of Alaska Fairbanks has entered into an agreement with Eielson Air Force Base to provide campus housing for service members. The deal would enable personnel from the base to live in two dormitories on campus that in recent years have been sparsely occupied. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
UAF officials say they plan to make room available in Stevens Hall and Nerling Hall early next month for almost 100 people from Eielson. That's the maximum number of tenants that university and base officials have set for the first year of the arrangement. That may increase in the years ahead, but for now, campus and base officials are just trying to get the process started.
Right now, the focus is on the introduction of these service members to the campus community, helping their move-in process, getting them acclimated to campus, orienting them to all of the benefits that come with this arrangement.
Campus officials announced the deal on Tuesday, but UAF Department of Military and Veterans Services Director Stephen Phillips says talks on the housing deal have been going on for months.
We've talked about this and negotiated terms for the better part of a year, but the agreement was just signed a couple of weeks back, so everyone realized at that moment, holy cow, the rubber's finally meeting the road. We've got to make this thing happen.
Master Sergeant Victor Caputo is an Eielson spokesperson, and he says base officials are now preparing to move personnel into the dorms at the UAF Trothieta campus.
As we navigate local housing shortages, securing space on the Trothieta campus helps us strengthen mission readiness as the installation prepares for incoming active duty KC-135 stratotankers and increased F-35A Lightning II manning.
The number of personnel and family members assigned to Eielson has grown sharply in recent years. And that's mainly because the Air Force in 2022 completed bringing 54 advanced F-35 jet fighters to Eielson that are now under the command of the 354th Fighter Wing. The number of personnel assigned to the Alaska National Guard's 168th Wing at Eielson also has grown, with the addition of four more KC-135 stratotankers. They bring the total number of air refueling tankers at the base to 12. The influx of all those new people into the Fairbanks area has contributed to a housing crunch. Caputo says he ran into that problem soon after he arrived at Eielson.
So I just got here 2 months ago, and it took me almost 2 months to find a suitable place to live.
Phillips says the Air Force will pay the university $2.7 million annually to cover housing and parking costs and to pay for service members' college classes and other support. He says many of those who've already signed up to live on campus have said they also want to take classes there.
We have airmen that are enrolled with us. They committed to taking college classes with us, and now they're seeking the next step, which is resident student on campus.
Phillips said UAF and IELTS officials anticipate they'll run into challenges in this first year, like potential traffic issues created by service members commuting 30 miles to and from the base.
I think both parties realize that if we can find people that have access to a privately owned vehicle, that would be the ideal fit for this.
He said planners also have explored other potential solutions to that challenge, like working out an arrangement with the borough's public transit system or leasing shuttle buses. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
The day after the season's first drift gillnet fishing opener, salmon remain top of mind for fishers of the Kuskokwim River. At Riverview Park in Bethel, community members gathered and filled plates of dried whitefish and grilled fresh-caught fillets of king salmon. The second annual Return of the Salmon event was put on by Mother Kuskokwim Tribal Coalition, a grassroots organization opposing the proposed Donlin gold mine. Supporters of the mine point to the job prospects it would bring to locals in the region. Chilista Corporation, the regional native corporation who owns the subsurface rights to the proposed mine site, says responsible development and subsistence can coexist. Others, like Mother Kuskokwim, say it's too risky. They argue potential contamination from the mine could pose dire environmental effects, namely for the region's salmon populations. The celebration is, at its core, an anti-Donlin demonstration. But it feels like a fish camp cookout. Organizer Gloria Simeon says, on the Kuskokwim, salmon is a mechanism for something bigger.
Fish camp is not an activity. Fish camp is the time, the single most important time of families coming together with one purpose, and that's to get prepared for the winter. Catch our salmon, take care of it, to have it for the winter. And it's not just only about that, it's about sharing your genealogy, your oral traditions, our cultural values, who we are as a people, our history.
She says in this way, the proposed Donlin gold mine is a threat to more than just a vital ecosystem and subsistence harvest. It's a threat to a way of life. She says the moments on display in a community event like this, children playing, babies having their first bites of fresh salmon of the season, that's what the Mother Kuskokwim advocates are trying to protect. Juneau's historic Treadwell Gold Mine is a beloved city park with trails and a nine-hole frisbee golf course weaving through the ruins. Hole 2 was placed next to where an oil tank used to be, and last summer, oil rose to the surface. As KTOO's Alex Solomon reports, the state plans to assess how wide the pollution has spread this summer.
A short walk down the trail from the end of St. Anne's Avenue on Douglas Island, a bright orange plastic fence circles the site of an old oil tank in the Treadwell Mine complex. The jagged metal rim is still sticking up several inches out of the ground. A sign reads, "Caution. Oil residue present. Please stay out."
They use bunker fuel, so it's similar to what the cruise ships use. It's a very dense, kind of tar-like fuel source.
That's Mark Wheeler, director of Parks and Recreation for the City and Borough of Juneau. He says a resident reported an oil sheen at the site last August.
It seemed to have made its way to the surface last summer.
But miners must have put it there more than a century ago. So why has it only recently come up? Since oil floats on water, it's possible that over time, rainfall saturating the soil in the area buoyed blobs of oil to the surface. Paulette Simpson is president of the Treadwell Historical Society. She says this oil tank was one of several. They were part of the mine's wintertime energy transition from coal to oil.
The first oil tanks went in 1907, and they were there for 10 years until the mine collapsed in 17. And then they were drained and, my understanding, cut off.
This one is called Day Oil Tank Number 8. Simpson says it could hold 10,000 gallons of crude oil, enough to run the central power plant next to it for 24 hours. The Alaska Treadwell Mining Company, responsible for leaving the oil behind, collapsed after a massive cave-in flooded most of the tunnels in 1917. At the time, there were no laws requiring mining companies to clean up their messes or to set aside funds for reclamation if the companies dissolved. Any remaining contamination at Treadwell falls under the purview of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. DEC's Brownfields program adopts abandoned industrial sites to clean them up. Flannery Ballard is an environmental program specialist with the Brownfields program. She says the first step is to study the problem. The state got a $25,000 grant from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to do that this summer.
It's one of the things we're going to investigate with our initial sampling. It's just, has contamination made out of the ring? If it has, how far widespread is it? How deep does it go, etc.?
She says sampling will be limited to the oil tank site and the area immediately surrounding it. After the initial assessment, Ballard says DEC will decide whether to apply for more federal funds to clean it up. She says she doesn't know how long it will take to clean up the pollution, since DEC hasn't yet studied how far it's extended. In Juneau, I'm Alex Solomon.
We end tonight's broadcast with a sad goodbye. An icon of journalism has died. Elizabeth Arnold started her reporting career in Bethel in the 1980s, working for the Tundra Drums. She moved to public radio, reporting for KTOO in Juneau in 1985. She became an NPR reporter after assisting with the coverage of the Exxon Valdez oil spill and covered Congress and presidential campaigns for NPR in addition to environmental reporting. In 2009, she came back to Alaska and became an associate professor within the University of Alaska Anchorage's journalism department. Her award-winning work was recognized and honored many times, the most recent being her induction into the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. I've known Elizabeth for a long time, first as an admirer of her NPR congressional reporting work, and then as we encouraged and mentored students. We served together on the Alaska Center for Excellence in Journalism Advisory Board, and she was unwavering in her support of journalism and especially young journalists. She was an amazing colleague, mentor, and stellar reporter who didn't mince words. And she leaves an important legacy of a life dedicated to truth-telling, holding elected officials to account, and helping Alaskans and all Americans understand the complex issues of our time. Elizabeth Arnold was 66 when she passed yesterday after a long battle with cancer. I will miss you, my friend. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Eric Stone and Alex Solomon in Juneau, Wesley Early and Rachel Cassandra in Anchorage, Hunter Morrison in Ketchikan, Samantha Watson in Bethel, and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us, news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Crystal Hyde. Jeremy Shea was tonight's editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.